This episode is brought to you by The Syllabus, a nonprofit knowledge discovery service doing artisanal automation. How does that work? Well, they use technology to monitor thousands of sources, and each week, human curators, that is actual people, handpick the best of what's been published on the internet. When you sign up, you get to set up your feed. You'll pick from 6 languages and 60 topics like far-right populism or energy and extractivism, heterodox economics or AI and automation. Everything's there. Each Monday, you'll get a new batch of personalized recommendations. And it's not just podcasts. It's essays and books, academic articles and reports, and even videos. And I believe, dear friends, that American Prestige and even maybe Daniel Bessner himself has been featured on The Syllabus. So check out their website, the-syllabus.com. And there's a hyphen between the and syllabus. That was the dash I said. They offer 2-week free trials. And if you enter Prestige at checkout, you'll get 30% off your first year. And to remember, that's Prestige, P-R-E-S-T-I-G-E. And you enter that at checkout for 30% off your first year.
That's kind of conversation between your soul. That's conversation between your soul and the night.
Hello, American Prestige listeners. It's Derek, and I am very pleased to be joined by first-time guest, hopefully not last time, but first-time guest, Marie-Rose Chite. She is a peace-building advocate and a PhD student in political science with a concentration in feminist, comparative, and international politics at the University of Cincinnati. Her current research interests focus on the experience of the women who were involved in peace negotiations that ended the Second Congolese War in 2003. And we are here today to talk about the situation in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo, with M23 having just a few days ago conquered the city of Goma and potentially moving on from there. So Marie-Rose, first of all, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me, for inviting me.
We're very, very grateful to have you, certainly to help us understand what's going on here. So why don't we start with the very basics? Let's talk about M23 and how it emerged following the First and Second Congo Wars. Take this back as far as you want. I know that this goes all the way, can go all the way back to the Rwandan genocide or even before. But tell the story of M23 and how it comes to be an institution and a player in the Eastern Congo.
Thank you, Derek, for the question. So first of all, I would like to mention that this is not the first time that the M23 is taking the city of Goma. So it did the same in 2012. But coming back to what you just asked, the story of the M23 is really linked to identity of a certain marginalized community that did not feel represented. And that's not even up to the genocide, but really back into how Mobutu governed the country. So you had a crisis of some population, which is recognized as the Banyamulenge, who have not really been accepted for long in the DRC. So that led to a lot of tensions. We had our first war in 1996. We had our second war in 2000 and in 1998, ending up in 2003. And then during the peace processes, which is called the Inter-Congolese Dialogue, that was happening in Sun City in South Africa, which was really one of the key players in trying to find peace in the DRC, we signed a peace agreement calling all the rebels on the table and starting a transition in the DRC. And mind you, the peace processes ended in 2003, and just a few months later, a rebellion started because those who did not really feel integrated in the peace processes went back. And it was called the CNDP, the National Congress for the Development, That was actually in 2003. And they were the most violent one in committing crimes. Up to 2003 to 2012, they were disseminated. But later on, that movement signed a peace agreement on March 23, 2009 with the government. That's actually where comes the name, because after being a rebellion group for long in the bush, trying to push for the integration, they came with an agreement with the Addisa framework. They came into a peace agreement March 23, 2009, but somewhere the agreement fell apart. They felt again that they were not deeply integrated, though there were efforts of many of the CNDP members who were integrated into the National Army. So that was 2009. It was a kind of win situation where done with the CNDP. But later on in 2012, those who did not feel integrated in the army or not well represented, I mean, their interests being represented, created the M23. So the M23 started mainly as name of M23 in 2012. They were able to take the town of Goma. Negotiation were actually facilitated by the UN and the European Union, who actually helped to disintegrate the M23 after they had taken the town of Goma. So we thought that was a win situation up to 2021 when we saw the re-emergence of M23. And the difficult part here, or people should know, that when the second time the M23 came, emerged from the public again, what we people should be aware of, the government of the DRC was already facing many conflicts in the Ituri region. Ituri is another province in the DRC, also in the eastern part, where you have a group, rebel group mainly, supported by Uganda, is said by many UN reports. So the government implemented what we call a state of siege, where the administrative territory is given to the army. A state of siege is almost like one level, especially legal regime above the state of emergency. So since May 2021, the government of Kinshasa, which is our national government, implemented the state of siege so that the military can take control of all those zones where we always have instability. But beside that, beside the fact that the army were already in control of this region, the M23 was able to emerge. That's one of the difficulties of trying to understand why the conflict doesn't end in the DRC. So you have a country which is controlled, I mean, the countryside, the eastern part, controlled by the army in the Ituri and in the north provinces, but the rebels emerged. They were able to take Bunagana, and they kept going up to the last 2 weeks, where we saw them actually being in Sake, like one city to take Goma. And the humanitarian crisis, the people running, like 2 million people trapped in Goma, even UN peacekeepers being trapped in Goma. But there is also some economic reasons, but because, as you can realize, the conflict is always east, most of the country, and the eastern part of the DRC is known to be the richest in terms of economic goods, coltan, anything you need for the cell phone. What the need, the world need these days, for all the technology. And there have been reports, and I was just looking at the last report of the UN published in December 2024, last year, of reports saying that neighboring countries, mainly Rwanda here, have been supported the Tutsi community who are represented in the M23, because most of the reports will say M23 Tutsi led rebellion. It was the same as well with the second war, when we had the RCD group. It was also a Tutsi rebel group. So in part of my conversation, like you said, I've been interviewing women who are part of the Sand City process. Like the Sand City process was happening in South Africa to try to solve the second war in the DRC. And there were 80 women in the room. And I'm in conversation with them for 3 years, trying to document their narration. And they kept saying that as long as first, the identity question is not resolved, and second, the economic reason, because the DRC not only profit to himself, but there is a lot of world interest. So the war has these two aspects of internal interest of or internal obligation that need to be met by our government in controlling the government, the country, because it is also recognized that the government in Kinshasa struggle to have control of its full territory, and the eastern side has always been like this part where it is difficult to control because the rebel has been there, have been there for 30 years. So sometimes you have this difficulty. This is an internal problem. And as long as this full effective control of the whole territory, including the east, is not resolved, that's an issue. And then you have the external reasons which are really linked to the economic interests that the minerals of the DRC, all the world needs the minerals of the DRC. So we are, the ladies usually use this word, we are in a cycle of repetitive conflict that is happening, a conflict that perpetually goes around in circle because we are not having effective open dialogue to see how we resolve the internal issues within the DRC in terms of capacity, control, effectivity of the government, and addressing the need of the population who are struggling, seeing an elite that is really rich and seeing a population that is really poor, and then seeing again international partners, Chinese, the US, and the UN, the EU, supporting Rwanda in terms of developmental heads to actually support Mozambique. But who knows where those monies are going? Because you know very well, and it is reported, and it has been documented many times, that the Rwandan government has been supporting the M23, even though recently we were watching the two UN peacekeeping missions. We had on Sunday an urgent UN peacekeeping mission. We had on Tuesday a second one. And most of them are really said we need the Rwandan government to stop its support to the M23. So how can an identity conflict get so much power to actually overthrow a full government in Goma? It means somewhere they have the support. And I guess as long as this external support is not also recognizing the conflict of the DRC, major power who are financing those who are supporting the M23 need to stop their backing of the M23 or have them sit with the government or otherwise in the different setting of platform to address the issue, because this cycle of violence will stay for generation. And we've seen what has happened in Sudan after when the war starts staying for long, we have a split of the country and we do not want that. And the worst situation will be having a third war in the DRC. That's actually what we are trying to not to. So yeah, the story of the M23 is linked to both internal to external factors, and it also linked a lot with identity of a certain community not being represented.
So comparing what you're seeing from M23 and Rwanda now versus the previous uprising in 2012, do you see any differences in how they're approaching control of Goma? I know it's only been, you know, not even a week at this point, but
business.
It from a very outsider, like, you know, layperson's perspective, it feels different. 2012 felt like the seizure of Goma was part of an effort to extract concessions from the Congolese government. There was a negotiation that followed that. It was a statement like, we want certain considerations as a community and certain rights. This time around, it feels like maybe it's because of the minerals, maybe it's because of the heavy Rwandan involvement, but it feels like we want Goma because we want Goma. We want to govern, we want to control it. And whether that means, you know, as some kind of autonomous thing within the state or something else, I don't know. It just feels to me like it's a different scenario, which I think has implications for how you resolve it and whether they're going to be willing to leave the city eventually for negotiations, or is this going to be a more protracted thing?
You're right. It's not the same dynamic. Definitely not. So what we had in 2012 was people trying to actually get a concession to be recognized. But right now, and since yesterday, the head of the M23 said, our aim is to come to Kinshasa. We are going to work from Goma to Bukavu to Kisangani. That's what they said. So you can basically sense that there is no need for them to stop. And what we should also understand, and this is happening after two recent failed peace processes. We were having the Nairobi peace process in December last year, and the Luanda processes as well. The Luanda processes where Rwanda and the DRC were sitting to try to have a diplomatic issue to the war, and the Nairobi processes with the East African community led by Kenyatta, the former president of Kenya, trying to have all the rebel group, because the M23 is not the only rebel group in the Eastern DRC. We have about more than 100. So yes, now we have this dynamic, which is not the same as 2012. What we have right now is something a little bit similar to what we had in 1998, because we have more countries involved, and Rwanda is not only one involved in that. You also have Uganda in some way also supported some rebel group. You have impact of the regional aspect of this. This time we have the SAMIC forces of SADC who are trapped right now in Goma by the M23. We have 13 South African soldiers who just passed away. You are seeing the different conflicts in terms of languages, discourse between South Africa and the president of Rwanda, Sir Paul Kagame. So the dynamic now is getting more into regional conflict between the Eastern African community, between the Southern African community, very much involved in the DRC, where they are there as peacekeepers, but they are also there for the interest of the regime in Kinshasa. So the M23 of 2012 was in the Nairobi peace process, felt like the government of Kinshasa did not want to talk to them. And the government of Kinshasa many times said, we are not going to talk to the rebel of M23. So they are doing this aspect of thing. Okay, you didn't want to talk to us. We are going to take Goma and we are coming to you. So we are not going to listen to anybody. So unless there is huge diplomatic pressure and sanction, there is no options right now in the discourse of the M23 that they want to back down. They really clearly show their intention of going in Bukavu, which is going to increase the number of people who are going to be in very precarious condition of living. Goma has spent 2 weeks without electricity, without water, bodies on the ground. So the dynamic is no longer the same. The dynamic has a regional, a very much huge regional aspect now. We have determined commanders of the M23 who are not going to back up. And you have a regime in Kinshasa who is also saying, we are not discussing with you, but we still want a dialogue. So you have those discourses that we are watching over the news. And clearly, unless there is pressure from those who have economic or some kind of forces on top of Rwanda, Uganda, and the government of Kinshasa, If those forces do not put pressure, we will stay in the same situation for a long time. And who are going to suffer in that situation? The population, the women, the children, and vulnerable people, as well as a lot of UN peacekeepers being caught trapped in this situation. You know, yeah, I agree with you. The dynamic is not the same. But my most regret is we are not learning from history. We are keeping repeating the same scenario that we've seen 20 years. 1998 was almost 20 years past right now. You know, so yeah, it's not the same dynamic as in 2012.
let's talk, you've alluded to it in your last answer a bit, but let's talk about what the situation is or what we know. I mean, obviously, it's hard to get a lot of information, or been hard to get a lot of information out of Goma. You mentioned reports of bodies in the streets. I know there've been attempts at casualty figures based on hospital data, but a lot of people probably never made it to a hospital, and we don't know how many. The humanitarian situation is, I know, pretty dire. The airport's under the control of M23, which means, you know, the ability to get things in is hampered, at least at the moment. So what's the what do you know in terms of the situation in Goma, and what do we know about the progress that the M23 has made in moving toward Bukavu and moving into South Kivu province? Where do things stand right now? I know that I saw that what you mentioned, that they're talking about going all the way to Kinshasa, which is probably a long term objective, but certainly Bukavu is pretty short term. Yeah. So where do things stand right now?
This is a very difficult question for me because I have family members in Goma. I have a lot of friends, and you wake up in the morning and you get messages of, we need to leave Goma because we are no longer secure. So what we really know is what the international community and reporters are saying, because I don't know if you're watching what is happening in Kinshasa. The government has said anyone who is going to say that Goma has fallen is going to be judged. And the Minister of Justice is just reinstated the death penalty, threatening anyone who is going to have a discourse different from the government. So already in terms of information, it's very difficult to have the right information depending on which side you stand. You have a news coming from East Goma, which is sponsored by those who have taken Goma. And then we have the other side of the government who are like, Goma is not fully taken by the rebel. We still have some control, you see. So in terms of information, that's the main issue. But what we know is mainly from UN agency, who are actually condemning that we have close to 2 million people into precarious condition, displaced people from wherever the M23 people, the army group has passed, people have been running away. This morning, just watching the news, bodies were on the floor. Women were running with whatever they can, holding their children into their hands. We have hospitals that are also targeted by those bombs because they already do not have electricity. They do not have water. And they are targeted in some places. That's the main situation that we are getting news to. But we are also getting news from friends who are activists who have actually run away because they do not want to be the next target or whoever takes into power. And Bukavu, I've lived in Goma in 2018. It's just close by to about 10 minutes with a boat. So this is the next step, and Bukavu gives to Kisangani. So I do not see how they will not take Bukavu because they already took Minova. Minova is another side of the South Kivu province, because the North Kivu is Goma and the South Kivu capital is Bukavu. So there is chances, and they said it, they will take the city of Bukavu, unless if there is a resistance, which does not seem to be happening very soon. Our hope would be if the government could put into place any kind of discussion to stop the move of M23 in Bukavu, because the number of people who will be displaced in the DRC will be probably more than what we have seen in Gaza, more than what we have seen in Ukraine, because the last report of the UN was talking about more than 400,000 people already displaced in the DRC from 2021 when the reemergence of M23 started. So the damage in terms of human security, even after the conflict will be resolved, will be difficult to resolve in many, many years to come.
In terms of the Congolese government's response, I know the language out of Kinshasa has been very much like, we're mobilizing a military response. We're calling out, you know, we're asking people to sign up. We're going to take all this territory back. Realistically, if the Congolese military could stop this, it would have already stopped it, right? I mean, we're at the point now where that is not going to happen. But can you talk a little bit for people who are trying to understand how this non-state actor, admittedly with state support from, it seems, from Rwanda, but nevertheless, this kind of non-state actor has been able to achieve all of this. Give people some sense of what the Congolese government's capabilities really are, especially in the east, where, as you already alluded to, the control is not always particularly strong.
I wanted to thank you for the question. This question is really linked to a lot with the post-conflict transition we had after the Sun City, because much of the Western approach after the Second War was to have the country reunify and have all the army rebel reintegrated into an army, national army, which we call the FAR, they say, coming together, and then having one single army. But what happened when you bring people from who have been fighting each other for years, and then form a national army with them? So this has made the DRC, since the 2006 democratic election, not to have a strong army. We have an army composed of different belligerents who came together for the sake of having a national army and for the needs to have a country unified under the pressure of many Western partners. And I think many, many authors like Kaplan will say that the DRC has not dealt with the main issue in resolving, but really trying to have a sense of answering the need of the donors. So that's one of the things. I wanted to point out that the DRC has not really shown to have an army since the beginning of 2006 that can fight and control the full territory. And not enough is, in terms of percentage, is allocated to the defense side of the budgets, national budgets, to the army. The army soldiers are usually poor, in difficult conditions, sent to the front with almost nothing. So this is one of the issues. So they have not been able to stop not only the M23, but many of the other groups that are terrorizing the population since then. That's one thing to keep in mind. So now that makes them in a difficult position to actually stop the rebellion that has been happening. They were not able to stop the M23 since 2021. I mean, the second re-emergence, there is no sign that they will stop them from going to Goma, because there is not a strong, unified army that can actually stand against them. You see, the M23 was able to even stop the peacekeeping mission in Goma recently. They were able to stop the SAMIG, the Southern forces, with South African, Malawi, and Tanzanian soldiers being trapped by the M23. So if external forces supporting the government of Kinshasa are being trapped, how do you expect the government of the Kinshasa to be able, with their soldiers, with an army which is not totally unified and functional, to stop? That's the thing. So coming back to the second part of the question, you have this in mind, then you ask yourself, how is any shift going to happen in those conditions? Bear in mind that we inherited a country that has been called a failed state already since Mobutu, a collapsed state. And then you have Kabila, who has tried his best, then Tshisekedi came. If you have in mind the last election, where a lot of people felt frustrated, including Nanga, who is currently leading the M23. So if people want to get a sense of that, there is first the defense, there is the security aspect, which is very poor, very slow, very disintegrated. And then you have the second aspect of political elite being frustrated, being feeling like the recent election has taken them away, the power that they've been held holding since the Kabila regime. A lot of opposition leaders are very frustrated in exile, including the one who is leading the M23. So those are aspects that gives us sign that we are not close to resolve the issues until the interest of particular actors, including external actors, are being resolved. We are not going to see any sign of peace happening very soon, or any humanitarian situation being resolved very soon, because Goma does not give any other country as a road. If you are in Goma, the only way to get out right now, it's through Rwanda. Unless you go to Bukavu, then you can go to Kisangani up to Kinshasa, and then the road is not really good, which is difficult. So even if humanitarian corridor need to be created, it will go through Rwanda, who are right now in difficult situation with the DRC. So I don't know if I fully have answered your question, but I think bearing in mind the difficult aspect of the security forces of the national country, of the national force of the DRC, bearing in mind the frustration of political leaders who have taken up the arm, because Nanga is one of the first frustrated leaders of the last election, feeling that the election was stolen, rigged. The Kinshasa regime felt like they consolidated their power lastly, but that did not actually pleased a lot. So yeah, those two aspects, I guess, should be considered in terms of understanding if there is any hope of a quick solution right now.
Americans are durable. We take pride in hard work and high quality. American Giant makes durable quality clothing right here in the USA, because what we wear reflects who we are. When you buy American Giant, you're not just wearing the best clothes money can buy. You're helping keep jobs and pride in your own backyard. Premium clothing built to last decades, like it should. Get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code RIGHTHERE24.
Taxes was taxing. Now taxes is relaxing when you file for free.
I can file for free? TurboTax Free Edition. Roughly 37% of filers qualify. Simple form 1040 returns only. See if you qualify at TurboTax.com/free. I can file for free.
Now this is taxes. File for free with TurboTax Free Edition and get your maximum refund. No schedules except for earned income tax credit, child tax credit, and student loan interest. See if you qualify at TurboTax.com/free.
So I want to talk a little bit more about specifically Rwanda's involvement. And you mentioned the humanitarian corridor. I mean, there was a report. I can't remember if it was the AP or Reuters, but somebody, like, the irony of people fleeing Goma and having no choice really but to flee into Rwanda, which is, you know, the country it's partly responsible for the reason that they're fleeing, which is just a sort of a bitter thing to have to consider. And yeah. What can we say in terms of how involved Rwanda has been? And let's talk a little bit about the motivations here, because I know when Kagame gets challenged on this, or you know, when the French government or the U.S. government says we'd like to see Rwanda stand down and get out of the Eastern Congo, his response usually has something to do with the presence of the Hutu militia, the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda, which traces its origins back to the Interahamwe and the genocide. And he frames this as self-defense, basically, for Rwanda. Like, it has to be in the Eastern DRC. It has to be working with M23 to protect itself from these, you know, former genocidaires, essentially. And yet, you know, it seems pretty clear that the mineral wealth is got to be part of the story here. I mean, not to question his motives, I guess, too much. But I'm sort of curious, what do we know about Rwanda's involvement, and what do we know about why Kagame is so involved in this?
No, thank you, Derek, for this question. I think it is mainly the UN report of 27 December 2024 that mentions the Rwandan forces coming. I mean, the last report that I watched, that I saw, was that the Rwandan forces were on the territory of the Eastern DRC supporting the M23, and there were about 4,000 soldiers. That was the UN report was saying last year in December. So in terms of Rwandan motive, why are they supporting, like you said, the national security of Rwanda is in danger as long as the FDLR are going to be in the DRC eastern side and working along what they are saying. I'm just saying what they are saying. I was watching yesterday, there were an Eastern African community urgent meeting, and the president of Rwanda was saying that as long as the FDLR are still there working with the government, it is a national security concern for Rwanda. So that's the Rwandan argument. And now they are working with the Congolese forces, but the SAMIC, the Southern African forces, were also supporting the government of Kinshasa, are working along. So he was condemning the UN peacekeeping of not doing their mission, but working along those who are destabilizing their national security. So it's mainly the main argument, as long as they do not see the whole FDLR being crashed down, they will still support any movement that can help them crash them into the earth. So standing from the side of the international community, and I wanted to say that's very ironic. Like I said, Goma, if you live in Goma, the only exit, because if Sake is taken, the only way out is Rwanda. You have no choice. So you find yourself being a refugee in the country that is actually backing the rebellion. How involved they are, the report is also saying that beyond just those security national concerns that Rwanda is advocating or saying, there is economic aspects, because the region that are being taken, like say the huge mine of Rubaya, we know that the treaty minerals are very important right now, and then they are under the control of M23. And people and reports, many observers are saying the Rwandans are not having the national security forces reasons. I mean, what do you say? The Rwanda is not only having national defense reasons, but they are also motivated by economic means in the region they are covering. Why so? If you recall last year, the European Union, signed a protocol with Rwanda to support them for producing or mineral resources that will help the development. But basically, the EU is financing Rwanda for humanitarian development reasons. I think it's close to 2 million, just frame it like that. So at the same time, Rwanda is a big ally to the UN in terms of peacekeepers, soldiers in Mozambique, in Central African Republic, is also training army like in Benin. So Rwanda is a major player internationally in terms of peacekeeper mission. And I was watching the South African minister on Sunday during the discussion of the UN urgent meeting, saying this is really ironic that we are dealing up with Rwanda backing M23, while Rwanda is also part of the biggest peacekeeping mission sending soldiers, and at the same time being accused of breaking the territorial sovereignty of another country. So this is something to keep in mind in terms of motivation. So coming back to France, I think today the foreign minister of France is in Rwanda to attend to talk to the regime in Goma. They were also yesterday in Kinshasa to try to have, but are they having strong argument for this to stop? We do not know. The reasons are very complex. As long as the M23 really is showing that they are not going to back up, the motivation of Rwanda is said to be in terms of protecting their national security. But many observers are saying economic reasons linked to being the hegemonic country that can actually satisfy the need of the West in terms of protecting their interest. Mozambique is a big case. An accusation of Mozambican opposition against Rwanda is also huge. We saw recently when the Mozambican people had their election, they accused the governing force of supporting the government, and the Mozambican opposition leader had to flee to South Africa to protect himself. So you find yourself with a country who is a big player, Rwanda, into the international forces in terms of providing mineral resources. I think Rwanda is producing those resources, not having them in their soil. That's where the accusation is coming, because you do not have the coltan. How can you be the first producer of coltan and all those minerals that you do not have in your country? And when you do not have it, we still see the EU. And one of the things we should really mention is, why is the EU silent right now? Because if it is the major contributor in terms of humanitarian development, giving money for Rwanda to support peacekeeping nation in different places in Africa, they should be saying something. Because the UN report of last year was one of the reports really accepted. And we've seen the shift in discourse in the two last UN meetings, like really country naming Rwanda as backing the M23. And this two meetings, we had more countries really citing Rwanda. And the sad part is many of the African countries like Algeria and Somalia, those were countries who were not even able to mention Rwanda as being back beside the report being there into their hands. So the motivation is one important reason, but the facts of the mineral and economic reasons behind the region of the Eastern DRC cannot be overlooked as one of the biggest reasons just behind the national security reason the Rwanda is advancing.
This leads, I mean, you've already really answered it to a certain extent, but I guess we should ask specifically about the international aspect of this and the Western, not just Western. I mean, you know, you can talk about China, you can talk about other international players as well, but the interest in this region, and it does really come down, it seems like, to extracting the minerals, extracting the wealth, and getting it to market, right? I mean, this is the big push that the Biden administration made toward the end by Joe Biden's one visit to Africa in 4 years was to push a train project to, you know, bring the minerals out to Angola, but out of this region, right? Out of the eastern, you know, the sort of Great Lakes region, eastern DRC. Rwanda, as you said, has made itself invaluable to the West, in part by protecting Total's investment in offshore gas in Mozambique. I mean, it's obvious, right, that this is what the international community wants. There is, I think, a point at which, when you have bodies in the streets, not to be too crude about it, where Western governments feel like they have to say something. But whether that gets followed up by anything, it certainly doesn't seem like anybody is interested in really rethinking aid to Rwanda or withholding it to sort of force any kind of change in policy. I'm just curious your impressions of what the West is really after here. And is it anything other than we just want to get this stuff out and buy it and sell it and trade it and use it in our phones?
I think the West has a lot to play in stopping this is what is happening in the DRC. And we've seen that with the inter-Congolese dialogue in 2002, 2003. The UN, the EU were bringing everybody on the table in South Africa so that we can have the country unified. If that was not done, probably the DRC would be divided in four by now. Because the second war of 1998 to 2003 was the bloodiest one, with 6 million people, according to the numbers that we've had. So you cannot bypass the need to have Westerners, European Union, the EU, and the United States and the United Nations saying something really strong or taking position. But what I've heard, and let me come back to most of the interview that I have with my the interlocutors, and especially the women, they said usually to me, as long as sanctions will not be put on the table, if we do not have sanctions, there is potentials that the world will not have. It's going to be the unending cycle of conflict and the repetition of that. So the West has to play in that because they have interest. Coming back to what you said about President Biden's recent visit to Angola, the Lobito Corridor, that was a big deal. And I guess before he left the White House, there were rumors that Rwanda did not want to be part of the conversation. But in the meantime, you can wonder why they would not want to be part of the Lobito, because the Lobito, in many sense, if it is played and done properly, has a lot of interest for the DRC government, because everything will be traced back, everything will be legal. The U.S. will have interest that is correct and seen, documented, as long as the DRC, as long as Zambia and all the people, countries involved. So anyone who has interest in having the war to continue so that they can take away illegally the money will not be okay with the implementation of the U.S. Lobito project with Angola, you see. So key players who have been gaining a lot behind backing the 100 rebel group in the DRC will definitely not be okay with a solution that is, let's trace back the mineral, let's make it so that it goes from Angola to Zambia and everything is traced back. The DRC actually, especially the Kinshasa government, will benefit a lot because the corruption that was left by previous government is still continuing. So a little bit of traceability and good governance, it's something that we welcome. But as long as the EU, knowing that bodies are laying down on the floor, seeing soldiers of UN peacekeeping missions being trapped, this is not conceivable. I am not this. When I get into that, I don't understand. It is actually international law and humanitarian law that are in the UN Charter to be respected. How can UN peacekeepers being trapped by rebel group and the EU and the UN is not taking direct sanction? Which communication do you give about the UN peacekeeping? This is a failure, and it's going to have precedent that the UN peacekeeping missions has actually failed in actually sustaining and keeping peace in a particular country. South African soldiers, 13 of them dead. Malawi soldiers. Last year it was Uruguay, Pakistani soldiers who lost their life in those conflicts. So the UN, the EU, if sanctions are not given to direct breakers that their reports are directly citing, we are not going to get out of this situation. And maybe you might be calling me again for another interview on why the war doesn't end in the DRC. The war doesn't end in DRC because there is no direct sanction from those who can actually make it happen, instead continuing to finance those who are supporting the rebel group in the DRC.
I think that's a good place to wrap up for now. And to your point, I'm sure that we will have you on again, because I think this is something that a conversation that needs to continue. But as we kind of close out, is there anything that you would like people listening to know, to understand about the situation, any place that they can go in terms of, donating or supporting humanitarian efforts, just anything along those lines that you'd like to leave people with?
I think my biggest message, mainly because I'm also a Congolese besides becoming now a scholar, it's we need to think about the people, the human security of people is the most important one. People are deprived from going to school in this time of war. People are deprived from going to hospital. So as long as those aspects are not resolved, that's another issue. My biggest message will be the EU as well as the UN needs to force the breakers of the M23 to open corridor for humanitarian help. we cannot have bodies laying on the floor like we saw in Goma, and the war continuing, and we still have, we condemn, we say this. Those discourses do not resolve the issue of people fleeing, of families being divided, or just in difficult situation. So maybe my message will be in terms of, let's protect the people. Let's protect the human lives so that people can have a chance to live decently, which they've been deprived of. Yeah, I think that would be my biggest message.
Marie-Rose Chita, thank you so much for coming on the program and helping us better understand the situation in the DRC. Obviously, our thoughts are with you and your friends and loved ones in Goma right now. And we look forward to having you back, hopefully under better circumstances.
Thank you, Dad.
This episode is brought to you by The Syllabus, a nonprofit knowledge discovery service doing artisanal automation. How does that work? Well, they use technology to monitor thousands of sources, and each week, human curators, that is actual people, handpick the best of what's been published on the internet. When you sign up, you get to set up your feed. You'll pick from 6 languages and 60 topics like far-right populism or energy and extractivism, heterodox economics or AI and automation. Everything's there. Each Monday, you'll get a new batch of personalized recommendations. And it's not just podcasts. It's essays and books, academic articles and reports, and even videos. And I believe, dear friends, that American Prestige and even maybe Daniel Bessner himself has been featured on The Syllabus. So check out their website, the-syllabus.com. And there's a hyphen between the and syllabus. That was the dash I said. They offer 2-week free trials. And if you enter Prestige at checkout, you'll get 30% off your first year. And to remember, that's Prestige, P-R-E-S-T-I-G-E. And you enter that at checkout for 30% off your first year.